Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you here tonight to what is our first presentation in our 2009-2010 Park University Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. We're very excited to be starting the third year of our series. It's amazing that we've been doing this for 3 years, and so happy to have you here tonight to welcome our first poet. I do need to thank the Missouri Arts Council, who provides partial funding for our series, as well, of course, to thank the library. We've partnered with the libraries with several of our presentations and really always enjoy coming here. And I'm delighted tonight to be able to introduce you to Hyde E. Erdrich. Hyde's published 3 collections of poetry: The Mother's Tongue, Fishing for Myth, and National Monuments, for which she just won Minnesota Arts Award in 2009. So she was saying her other books had been nominated, and for this one she won, which is great. She also has co-edited Sister Nations, Native American Women on Community. She's written a play titled Curiosities, a play in 2 centuries, that received a stage reading as part of the Alternate Vision series at Pangea World Theater in 2005. Hyde is a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe. She was raised in Wahpeton, North Dakota, where her parents taught at the Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school. She co-founded the Turtle Mountain Writing Workshop and Birch Bark House, a nonprofit indigenous language and literature clearinghouse, with Louise Erdrich, her sister. And again, her books have each been nominated for the Minnesota Book Award, and she has earned degrees from Dartmouth College and the Johns Hopkins University Writing Seminars. This is her first visit to Kansas City, and I think I've already convinced her to come back, which is great. Gave her a tour today. And she also was interviewed for New Letters on the Air program, which will air at the end of November on our NPR. So join me in welcoming Hyde Erdrich.
Thank you so much, Virginia, and thank you all for coming. It's so nice to have such a warm crowd to read to. And I love reading in libraries because I get to talk out loud. I'm still from that generation where we
had to be very quiet in the library.
But also, I love books so much. I am just very fond of being in the presence of all these other voices that are between covers. I'm going to read from my new book, National Monuments, and this is my third book of poems. I've edited some other books and have published in other genres as well. But this book was a book that came very quickly, and I'll sort of tell you the story of this book as I read it. I like, especially when I'm with a group that's small enough so that we can all talk to one another, I love to be able to do a question and answer session where I have time to read a poem if it has to do with the answer of the question. So I'll read for about 30 minutes, a little bit more, and then I'll ask for questions, and I will read some more poems in response. So this is the way it usually works for me, and I'm very happy to do that. This book, National Monument, started out as a book called Ghost Nation. And as I was writing the book Ghost Nation, everybody started doing this something, or no, it was called American Ghosts. I'm sorry, there's a poem called Ghost Nation that I wrote as part of the American Ghosts series. And that series of poems was about the image of Native Americans in our national literature, in American literature, especially by American masters, places where a poet might reference an American Indian. And one of the poems that had always sort of haunted me was a poem called For Elsie by William Carlos Williams. And some of you might be familiar with that poem, in which he describes how the pure products of America go crazy unless it be married with a dash of Indian blood. And so then he goes on to talk about this Elsie, this housekeeper who goes and bathes in filth on the weekends and goes around with boys and has big breasts and all these things about her. And somehow it's to help us understand why our American imagination is the way it is. And this was a poem that I heard told to me many, many times. So those of you who are familiar with that poem will understand that I wanted to give Elsie voice. I wanted her to have a chance to speak. So this is called Some Elsie. I'm just getting used to wearing these other glasses that you have to wear when your eyes get old. I always forget until I look down at the book and it's not there. Some Elsie. And there she sits, Elsie, in American Lit, at the community college or Harvard or the U. The sleek New York TA reads how her family married with a dash of Indian blood and thus escaped the fate of the pure products, William Carlos Williams saw go crazy. Does she sit terrified or transfixed, waiting for someone else to turn, look at her and think, there she is, that Elsie. So what if she was hemmed all around with murder, or if a few of her relatives had a screw loose? She'd deny bathing in filth from Friday to Sunday. What a girl does on the weekend, well, that's her own affair. She endures the comments about her body, the great ungainly hips and flopping breasts. What if her ample chest had been her pride? What if, at first, she flushed at the sound of voluptuous water and took it as a compliment? What if at first she thought, oh, at last, a poem about someone I know, imagining that she'd strain after deer too if stuck in the suburbs passing pills like William Carlos Williams. But now, even knowing her hips somehow become a text, the TA says, doesn't help the sting when she thinks there's some truth she'd like to express, broken brain or not. So, oh, thank you. I was so glad when Virginia introduced me and brought me here for this reading, and I also, too, want to thank the Missouri Arts Council and the library, the Kansas City Public Library, but especially Park University. It was very wonderful to be invited to do this, and it was great to be able to be on New Letters, so I want to thank Angela Latham, too. In the back of this book, National Monuments, I have a brief introduction that explains how I came to write a series of poems about DNA and bodies and pickled hearts and all sorts of skulls and human chimp half-breeds and all these strange things that I have read about. And it explains a lot about reading on the internet and getting more information about how we treat bodies after death as human beings. And there's a little sort of prose poem embedded in that author's note. Unearthed. Nothing much stays buried in the dark. Not much left an e-search won't excavate. Rat-chewed nuts prove Maori tenure on New Zealand. And Tume, sweet speckled skull of a human chimp half-breed, these unearthed and brought to light on our computer screens. Stable isotopes of DNA teased from mummies determine corn-fed children died fat and happy. Follow a link to the words of an Incan girl who said to a Spanish chronicler, finish with me now because the celebrations they held for me in Cusco were enough. Dig the internet and you'll find skullduggery abounds. Osceola's head, removed by an army surgeon and embalmed, traveled north to wind up in the Surgical and Pathological Museum, burned to the ground in 1866, but stories of Osceola head trips persist. Black Hawk, also beheaded, skull lost to museum fire, might envy Geronimo, whose head bones get kissed by Yale's presidents-to-be, if we are to believe the boast of Skull and Bones, the Bush and Kerry secret sect, who seemed to believe the tales themselves, who offered Geronimo's descendants a skull, whose toothy death's head smile turned out to be that of a 10-year-old child. More wonderful to find 5,000-year-old gum dug up by students in Finland yields DNA. We don't know what we don't learn from those quids mouthed millennia ago, we may well find in fossil feces. True, it's true. Coprolites, 14,300 years old, predate Clovis. An open land tenure questions never dreamt of by an ancestor who kept his head but dined on grouse, then took relief in a cave one fine, long, long ago day, just now come to light once more. That sort of explains where I was headed in this book and how I got interested. So between poems that respond to ghosts of American literature, I look at sort of the haunting of our museums and collections by bones and skulls and so forth. This poem responds to Robert Frost, the inaugural poem that he ended up reading or speaking out loud because it was too cold and too long to read the poem he'd actually written for John F. Kennedy's inauguration. He did the poem The Gift outright. And I'd always thought, I don't know about that gift part. So I wrote this poem, The Theft Outright. We were the lands before we were. Or the land was ours before you were a land, or this land was our land, it was not your land. We were the land before we were people, loamy rumors rising, so the stories go, or formed of clay, spit into with breath, reeking soul. What's America but the legend of rock and roll? Red rocks, blood clots bearing boys, blood sands, swimming being from women's hands. We originate originally spontaneous as hemorrhage, unpossessing of what we still are possessed by what we now no more possess. We were the land before we were people, dreamy sunbeams where the sun don't shine, so the stories go, or pulled up a hole, clawing past ants and roots. DNA in documentaries scoff DNA evidence off. They landed late, but canyons spoke them home. Nomadic Turkish horse tribes they don't know. What is America but the legend of stop and go? Could be cousins left on the land bridge, contrary to popular belief that was a two-way toll. In any case, we'd claim them, give them some place to stay. Such as we were, we gave most things outright. The deed of the theft was many deeds and leases and claim stakes and tenure disputes and moved plat markers still stolen today. We were the land before we were a people, earth divers, her darling mud puppies, so the stories go, or emerging fully formed from flesh of earth, the land not the least vaguely, realizing in all four directions, still storied, art-filled, fully enhanced, such as she is, such as she wills us to become. So that poem enjoyed a little popularity right around inauguration time, right after the book came out. It was about a month later was inauguration for Obama. Oh, thank you. It's a roly one. It's kind of a shape that I thought was bound to cause trouble. So once I started talking about Elsie or sort of speaking for her, which I do in these poems, I speak for people who kind of haunt literature and who bones that are put in collections, and I just, you know, can't help but take on these little personas. So I couldn't leave Elsie alone, so I followed her imagining she worked for William Carlos Williams, who, if anybody knows his writing, you know, the so much depends on a red wheelbarrow and, you know, the chickens in the rain and all that. And they're all really tiny little poems. But I found out he wrote a lot of them on prescription pads. It may not be true, but, you know, so they were really tiny. And I kind of thought, what would happen with Elsie if she was dropping off his dry cleaning? So it was supposed to be Elsie drops the dry cleaning off, but they edited it so it was properly Elsie drops off the dry cleaning. What's this in his pocket? A prescription pad? If only she were bad, she'd write some lewds. But instead, she thinks to pen a few lines, like the master himself, confine her desires to the square under his name and RX. In the time it takes to the rack to rotate, her orders in, starch the white coats, press the slacks for pickup in 2 days. Meanwhile, her mind's a hummingbird, flits words to square, then darts away. She needs more room, more lines. Next door over's office supplies, Big Chief tablets, thick with lines, the pulpy paper almost moist, acrid, so soft pencils rip it. She buys crayons instead. This is how Elsie winds up in American Lit. First her words on Big Chief, then in years, son of Big Chief tablets appear. Her career as a house girl is long over. She hitchhikes Oklahoma, Colorado, South Dakota, takes lovers. But her braids and shades warrior without feathers, whose beads and groovy vest protect her words, does more for her than one man ever could. Son of Big, as renewable as wood, dependable. Tablets get her through the 70s, drug-free, nearly sober, raising kids in hell for aim, Then one day she enrolls in college, reads and writes, straddles a canyon, straddles a cannon, makes a name. So there she goes, Elsa. Seems like somebody I know, you know? A lot of women who work so hard, American Indian women who work so hard, people. That's the beginning part of the book, which is American Ghosts, which has to do with dealing with literature and the ghosts in literature. And from there I moved into the subject of how bodies and bones are presented. A lot of what I was writing about, you know, Osceola's Head and Black Hawk's Head, poems that didn't get into the collection. I was really curious about these things, but I wasn't sure why I was writing about them and what they had to do with these literary ghosts that I was writing about. And then one day, a friend of mine, a poet, Leslie Adrian Miller, who went to school in Missouri, considers herself a Missouri poet, she asked me if I wanted to go to see one of the body exhibits with those plasticized people, you know, and I just immediately said, no, oh my God, no, I couldn't go to that. And she, at the time, was writing a beautiful book of poems on anatomy and the first studies of human anatomy and how they were really about women and about women's bodies, which were so mysterious that people even, you know, thought that women could give birth to litters of rabbits because somebody famously had, she wrote a poem about how somebody famously tricked the royals in Europe by pretending to produce litters of rabbits. But nobody, you know, people didn't know, and she wrote this beautiful book about how medical anatomy, the texts were first written. So she was very into anatomy at the time, and we'd had many conversations about it. And I said, no, I don't want to go to this plasticized show, and I didn't know why not. And she was also, you know, sort of concerned about it and didn't want to bring people bringing their children there, and she was like, oh, no, I'd never do that. But we talked about it, and I realized it was something to do with the fact that when I was growing up, not too long ago, not yet 50, there, you would drive around, and some of you probably remember this, there'd be little signs on little small historical museums or county museums that would say, come visit our Indian bones, or we have real Indian bones. And the bones of Native people were displayed, yeah, some of you remember that, it was not uncommon. And millions of sets of remains have been returned under what's called the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, which required by law what most of us think would be required by simple decency, the return of these bones. But, you know, a lot of people don't quite understand that, and there's just varying attitudes. But here was this completely legitimate show of human bodies, and I didn't want to go, and I realized it was because I had a different feeling about the display of bodies having come from a group of people to whom the display was not voluntary by any means. So body works. Oh, and then I said I'd never go, but I was going through the airport in Pittsburgh, and there was a small version of the show there, and I had to see it by accident, but the poem will tell you how that happened. Body works. She labors. She efforts. Raw as mutton, she functions. Beloved body, never leave me. Never lend museums your tissues, triceps, glutes. Do not expose your inner works, as some corpse did, in a busy airport where a gray curtain gap showed me jerked and plasticized muscle as my walkway glided past. Work, just work, grin a death's head beneath my plump and living cheeks, but never leave me, body. I will not make you art. Even now, she pumps, spasms, pulps my dinner within her. She works. Her blue fluids, meaningless and messy, illustrate nothing of her fine compunction, systole and distole. She does it all, free and out of love for me, or so it seems. She works, she labors. My children, made in her, came waxy and bloody enough. Why would I want to know any other innards than hers? What intimacy has she spared me that I'd find splayed, preserved, and presented upon a platform with expert didactics? Work, just work, make love, What better act could she perform in plastic? Never leave me, body. There's just one of me and uncounted insatiable others lined up to get a look at what I take for granted. Guts, gonads, gallbladder, your brilliant splash and gulp, hot hemoglobin, vibrant hum of human synapse, electricity that if we listen closely sings in any body. Any body, believe me, bodies work. We're proof enough, or should be. Thanks. Again, a little true story. I read about how the feds had busted somebody who tried to sell skull on eBay. They claimed it was a Hawaiian warrior. eBay bones. Her skull goes to the highest bidder. eBay bones. Her skull goes to the highest bidder. How much would you give for a warrior head? Hawaii's history for an ashtray. She was not much older than me. Woman of volcanic earth, so rich she probably eased into the loam like her shawl, wrapped up warm for her final sleep. They should have buried her more deeply, should have thought of science's creepy needs. She should have known the web would one day hold our dead in its sacred sites. The grave may be a fine and secret place, but kept a fine secret only for some. Others are history. And history must be brought to light in the flash of an empty eye socket. Someone will pay for this. Someone did. Her ivory grin worth less than human curiosity, less than the rest of all humanity, all beneath us all. This discovery series section of this book, we're all prompted by my RSS feed. You know, I have Gmail and I'll be working and Googling about, and it decides there's certain things that I should know. You know, it thinks it knows me. So I wrote back to it by communicating with some ideas I had. And here's one that starts out with the Discovery News piece from May 2006. A carbon-dated fossil called Toumai is believed by many scientists to be the oldest known human. Others, however, dismiss Toumai as an ape. My beloved is mine. My love and I, in your long ago, side by side on the sea-beaten isle, me, her Zeus, her Jove, her Caliban, too. Her kind hands, her pink-tipped touch, speckled lips lined and expressing nothing but love and urgency. The heart wants what the heart wants. But let me say at once, we never shared ancestors or parted ways to chart separate descendants, split our differences. And though she was no hobbit, as some have called her, she was small. Small, round-headed Toumai. She loved me, that I know. H. sapiens, I whispered. H. florentius. We went everywhere together, gathered lusciousness the island afforded, and clung to each other nights when she grew helpless in her wild heat, and I could not help but be a man and give her some relief. Yes, we made our tender moments. We bred and brought forth young, as quick and brown-eyed as lemurs. Moon calves and freckled whelps, they frightened Toumai at times, their greedy love of mother, their ravishing humanity. Huge so soon, they tumbled her from time to time, tugged her tufts of fur, and teased her when they grew clever. So it is we fed among the lilies, while I peopled the island with our race, all born of Toumai. How it pains me to hear, you've carbon dated her, your oldest known human, your Eve. Once she was everything to me, brown and warm and womanly. She elevated me, made me my best, made me a man. Me, her Adam, her husband, her Caliban, too. There's a lot of, oh, thanks. Anybody who knows Shakespeare knows I ripped off a lot of the language in that. But if you can't rip off Shakespeare, who can you rip off? But it was an interesting debate to find out, like, who was the oldest bones? You know, where are they? Where are they now? And as I read different articles, I became convinced that we are all, every living human being, really primate hybrid of something before humans and chimpanzees, because we have like a lot in common with them. So, and I feel like a chimp some days, so yeah. So that doesn't insult me at all. Or maybe we're bonobos on this continent, or this half of the world, I don't know. Another famous set of bones is Kennewick Man. Do any of you know who Kennewick Man was? Yeah. So in Oregon, they found this skeleton, and it's over 9,000 years old, and they think Kennewick Man is white. I don't know how they get that. It's really, there's very limited frame of reference. There are no other bones that old. But people actually use that, as they do, for these racial arguments, which are ridiculous arguments. Like, well, if the first person, the oldest bones here were white, then the whole continent doesn't belong to these native people anymore. I'm like, oh yeah, sure. It couldn't have been just one lost white guy. It was. You never want to read it that way. It's give it all back because... So they're fascinated with this guy, Kennewick Man, and people fight over him. Some people say the bones should be given to these sort of pre-Christian folk groups that are based on European traditions, and other people say, give him to the nearest tribe and let them put him back, and the scientists say we need him, we need to study him. So the poor bones are going around, and I thought I'd give him a little chance to speak. So he's having a press conference. Response to this quote from the New Yorker that said, "We didn't go digging for this man. He fell out. He was actually a volunteer. I think it would be wrong to stick him back in the ground without waiting to hear the story he has to tell." So Kennewick Man tells all. "Ladies and gentlemen of the press, Kennewick Man will now make a brief statement, after which he will answer questions as time permits. I am 9,200 years old. I am bone. I am alone." That's all he'd say. What else could he say? And then James Chatters, the guy, the forensic anthropologist who is obsessed with Kennewick Man, also said to the New Yorker, "One evening I turned on the TV and there he was, Patrick Stewart, Captain Picard of Star Trek, and I said, my God, there he is, Kennewick Man." And the eye just cracked me up. I got a thing for Captain Picard, so Jean-Luc. So I thought, once they ask on, not that I know, I'm a very, very long-term happily married woman, but I've heard that you have to say what movie star you look like on some of the cyber date places. So Kennewick Man attempts to cyber date. "So when cyber date asks me what I look like, I'm no liar, Jean-Luc Picard. Not like I expect to match a hottie, not looking for Barbie in Kennewick Man, but to smell a woman's neck again, or just fill all required fields to simply state my age, my race, my God." Poor Kennewick Man. So one of the big things about the finding of this person is that these arguments that we need to return him to various spiritual groups seem sort of moot, because he predates any evidence of religion in humanity, any sense that, from an anthropological perspective, that they're... Any name for God that we still have. So one of the things I thought is, he's waiting in some university somewhere to be studied further. And what's he going to do with his time? I thought he might swim laps. Because in 2007, we learned that for more than 40 years, the bones of about 12,000 Native Americans have been kept in the drawers and cabinets under the swimming pool of the Hearst Gymnasium next to the museum. At Berkeley. This is something from the Los Angeles Times. Kennewick Man swims laps. "Aquamarine with navy lines to keep me in my lane. Lap, lap, lap. Again and again until I hear their watery voices beneath, repeating all I said when dead. Peace, peace, peace and sleep. A few cry out, "Remember me," but I am older than prayer and remember only river talk. Lap, 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 then turn in aqua, agua. I'm used to water, lay dead along a river's edge 9 millennia. But water here is unnatural, vivid. Still, I am older than religion. Gotta keep limber. Lap, lap, lap. Aqua's such an off color, new to me like rubber, milk, electricity, and jealousy. Tribes and pre-Christian folk groups claim my waterlogged bones as their own. So too the dead under Lane 7. Lap. May day the Morris dancers, subversive at sunrise along chilly urban riverbanks, shake bells and batons and ribbon bands. Perhaps my kind? Lap, turn. There is no mine. I am older than any name for God, swimming in the voices of blue-green ghosts in a place where color speaks, the way pool water changes shades, renames itself with every ripple, every wave. Poor Kennewick man. Am I at 5 or 10 minutes before? Okay. This was such a strange project. I ended up feeling sorry for people like Marie Antoinette, who whose son's heart was pickled, and he was, you know, for 4 years he was tortured and then died of TB. And they pickled their heads, their hearts, and for some reason they put her son's heart in DNA in alcohol, so there was enough DNA to test her mitochondria against it, and they in 2004 found out that the lost dauphin was not lost. He did die in prison, and things like Nefertiti, they did a study on the bust of her, that, you know, the famous bust of the Egyptian goddess, Pharaoh's wife, and they turned out that to make a claim that she was old. She was a mature woman, as they said. She had bags under her eyes. So, you know, I started feeling these strange things, and Pharaoh, poor Ramses, had a hank of his hair was stolen, and a post office guy in France tried to sell it on the internet and got arrested, and there's Iraqi, one of the ministers in Iraq is following all the things that have been stolen since the Gulf War, and they have spies on the internet trying to find these things, and it's just, you know, a crazy world out there of bones and pieces of hair and stuff going around, and people are still trading in human bodies and body parts, and, you know, and I mean, not to mention just the like extent of actual human slavery out there, which is horrifying. But it was shocking to me, but it was also sort of giddily exciting to find out all the science involved in it. So it led me toward looking a little bit about stuff about DNA. So here's a really quick poem about that kind of leads towards my next book, which is a lot about DNA and indigenous and small ethnic populations' rights to their own DNA. This is in the New York Times. Recently, contact with the outside world has brought the Carichiana access to the internet, where they discovered that their blood and DNA samples are being sold online. Vial. Tube of red like a lipstick, passion's paint, paid for, yet unpaid for, filched like a drugstore compact pinched. Glass finger, slender vial of DNA, for sale to nonprofits, yet non-bought, non-paid for. Promise medicine, Carichiana, Amazonian indigenous, offered blood and got nothing. Rich and red, blood of hunger, bled in fear of the next world wanting the body whole. Each drop accounted for. When they sell it all, they'll come back for more. And then I'm just going to read one more quick poem before we do some conversation. Oops, I lost track of my poem. Well, I'll just go to questions, and then I can get back to my poem. I'll remember it while I'm talking to you. So do we have some questions or comments? Yeah. No, I didn't really want to touch that. It's a very interesting thing, the ghost dance religion. Some of you might know about it. It was a passion that swept the country, a vision of returning people to power, native people to power. The ghosts of the people would rise up and there'd be a ghost army. The person, Vavoka, his history was really interesting. I mean, he was a preacher and he was involved in several fantastic hoaxes to get people to believe in him as a preacher. He's a Christian preacher. And a lot of people still keep the ghost dance practice very close to them, so I didn't want to get into that and get in any trouble. Although I was curious about it, and I make little slight references to some of the songs from the ghost dance that I've seen translated. So there's a poem in here called Ghost Keeper, which is about a practice of feasting a ghost for a year after you've had a death. And there were people who kept the ghost of, especially of a child in some cultures. And so they weren't allowed to do anything. They weren't allowed to have sex or even some of them scratch themselves or eat meat or do anything. They had to keep that ghost happy all year long. And then once the ghost was happy at the end of the year, they would have a big party in a ceremony. So I have a poem called Ghost Keeper. It's called Ghost Keeping, and in English, it was a practice where some tribes kept the ghost for the year. They were the ones who kept track of it and made sure it was appeased and had food and a warm place to stay. I'll read I'll read the poem. In 1882, Alice Fletcher, who studied a number of groups, including the Cheyenne, said, "The keeping of a ghost lodge is a signal of peace and cancels all grudges between parties. Ghost keeper. Orphans and the aged feast at the shadow lodge, open to the needy and the one who lingers. No person who holds a grudge, no person who goes to war or means another harm may enter where the father of the fallen child keeps vigil, keeps the ghost all year. Every day the food is set, but ghost keeper must eat no meat scrapings, nor can he leave. He must not shake his blanket or disturb the air where the child lingers. He must be as a ghost himself. He must not butcher or crack bones when he eats, nor take a weapon, nor hold his wife, nor pick up any child. He must not lift the living children who are the envy of their shadow sibling, the kept ghost who must draw near to them. When it ends, the months of mourning, it ends for good. The kept one released, the gifts are given, buffalo robes, quill work, woven sashes, calico, pipes, tobacco, hatchets, 4 days of gifts, moccasins, knives, leggings, bells, blankets, reed weavings, bows, shawls, gifts for all, and all attend the feast of dried cherries and squash and pounded meat. And the ghost keeper lifts each child, gallops them about like a pony gone wild." So that's sort of, so some traditions with ghosts I did mention, but, you know, those are people's traditions, and you don't want to go around messing with them. I don't mind messing with the Pharaoh, and, you know, those guys are pretty long gone. I'm not scared of them. Some other questions, or? No, I haven't studied Wovoka extensively at all. There's so many things in the world to study. That one just doesn't interest me. You know, I read the stories from two different accounts about who he was. I like reading 19th century stuff. I was telling Virginia that. I think someone in the back had their hand up, but I got the old lady glasses on, so you can help me, Virginia, if people are raising their hands. Yeah, sometimes I'll put a little crumb in my poem of something real, but, you know, my life is just not all that interesting. So I like to, you know, really extrapolate from one thing to another. And, you know, I love to, when I get to read to people, which I love reading to a crowd more than I like to publish in a magazine. I really love to do that. I get to tell the little bits and pieces. And I do write essays sometimes about the same subject as a poem. I write it as an essay. So I have quite a few autobiographical essays, nonfiction pieces, where I try to sometimes go over the same territory, but with a broader stroke. So someday I'll put them all together in a book. Thank you for asking. Birch Bark House is a nonprofit that I founded with my sister to publish Ojibwe language, which is the language in our family that was last spoken by our grandfather as a native language. He spoke many languages, but that was one that he spoke from his mother, who was Ojibwe, as well. My family is just a bunch of different kinds of people. And my sister was just the subject of one of those Skip Gates documentaries for PBS. Have some of you seen those? Oh, they're fun. He goes back through people's family history and then, you know, Henry Louis Gates Jr., sorry. I'm not, like, familiar with him, but he calls himself Skip, so he introduced himself as Skip. And by the way, he's about this tall and uses a cane, so there's no reason he could have, he was arrested. That's just ridiculous. But in any case, they went back and they studied the white side of our family, which I didn't know that much about other than my father, who's German. So we had some ancestors who spoke other languages, but that's a long aside. But it was very interesting to find out about them. In fact, I don't think I can tell you about it because it'll be on PBS in February. But one of them was a translator of a different native language, so that was a big surprise to us. But we both had this real interest in helping with indigenous language recovery, which people don't necessarily understand. But in order to be a people, you don't just need your cultural habits, you need your language. You know, that's what makes us think the way we think, and that's what helps us with our customs and our spiritual beliefs and our foods and our understanding of the place we live. And so we have both been studying Ojibwe, our language, and we wanted to make that easier for others by publishing books in the language so that people can study it. There's a lot of people who write in their own language, or they would if they were supported. So we started a nonprofit to support the publication of Ojibwe language materials. And we have a couple books out, but we're looking at our first big book series for kids. And it's been written. We're just doing the illustrations and getting the rest of the money for publication. It's very exciting. I think we will never have a lack of resources. We have dozens of projects lined up. We just don't have enough money to make it happen yet, but we're trying. And I left a tenured job at a university really to start doing that and devote myself to that work, because we only have a couple thousand native speakers left in Minnesota, and we need to work with them now. Some tribes only have 6 or 7 native speakers, and they need to record everything so that people can learn the language with native fluency. It's extremely important. And no dictionaries. There's wonderful dictionaries. That's the sort of thing an academic press would do. We do memoirs, stories. We're more of the literary and creative fluency side of the coin. Although recently we looked at a beautiful map with place names in Dakota and Ojibwe, which was really exciting to look at. So who knows? People bring us stuff, you know, and it's just so fun. I have a book of hymns written in Ojibwe that we're going to have for downloads. We're connected to my sister Louise's bookstore, Birch Bark Books, and I know we were going to have a book signing, but this book, I'm really happy to say, the first printing sold. So it was being reprinted, and the timing didn't work quite to bring or have books available for you. But if you just Google birchbarkbooks.com, there's a website, www.birchbarkbooks.com. You can order any of my books, and in the little note section, say you want it signed and how you want it signed, and I'll sign them, and they'll send them to you. And part of having the book, the website available, is that we sell Ojibwe language materials and Dakota language materials off the website, and that's part of the community service and nonprofit service that we do to the Native communities, and nobody else does it, so it's really a particular thing to be able to do for people, and we appreciate it. So, in my tribe is huge. My particular tribe, there's more Ojibwe than any other group except for the Diné, the Navajo, and if you count all the Cherokee together. But we're about equal. There's a lot of Ojibwe because there's a lot of Ojibwe in Canada as well. There's very large communities there. So, but my particular band, my particular tribe, there are about 30,000, and you know, about 11,000 of them live in a little reservation that's about two townships. I'd say it's not very big. It's real small. He's lived near there. That's man. So that's a particularly big group, and you know. There wasn't anybody I met who wasn't related to me, so I didn't marry in my tribe. But it was a heavily Catholic group and an interesting group. But there's dozens of Native Ojibwe communities in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and there's I even heard that there was a little Ojibwe land in Kansas when I was visiting over there the other day. People got moved all over the place, as you know, so. But Ojibwe people live all over, and there are many, many native speakers. So we're one of the most viable indigenous languages in North America. Ojibwe means a couple of things. It means who we are as people. It might also be related to the word Ojibige, which means to write, because we were people who had a petrographic language system. Which we still use, so that they always say, you know, nobody in North America, there was no writing in the New World. That's not exactly true. There were language systems that people used for, that were, you know, they were complex and they were very useful and people put them on scrolls. We didn't write the way people wrote in English, French, and so in German at the time. But then again, most people who were English, French, or German were completely illiterate, so I don't know if it made that big a difference. People say there were no libraries, but there were libraries at Tenochtitlan that were burned down, huge libraries in Mexico. And, you know, you can still read Mayan and Incan scrolls. So there was a literature, and there was, of course, a very deep oral literature that by many people is still practiced today and had a lot of rich storytelling and music and poetry. So... It means the name of us. It's us, you know, just like American, or it's sort of a national as well as, it's kind of loose. It's hard to say. Our language is Ojibwe. We call ourselves Anishinaabe, which means the original people, just like human means, you know. Everybody called themselves the same thing, human, basically, in whatever. Your enemies may have called you something different, and they often did. So. Yeah? Oh, wonderful. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I was told there were no books. Oh. Thank you. Oh, no, that's really good to know. That's great. Thank you. I just wasn't... Sorry, I had the wrong information. But so then I will get to sign books, so I don't want to go on too long. So shall I read one more, and then we can... Okay. You know, I don't remember what I was going to read. I had one more. That never happens to me. I had... But there's one that I do like to read at the end of my readings, and it's also from a little RSS feed thing that popped up, and it was a little note from Discovery News that told me, the ghostly spiral arms of galaxy M106 were first detected in radio waves, contain no stars, and do not match up with the curved starry arms of the galaxy as seen by telescopes in visible light. Ghostly arms. We never know the moment we end it. An embrace spent, time slips between the moments lovers let go and find it over. Arms across the universe reach and grasp at nothing but the emptiness of space. We never know the moment we end it. How warm were my arms the last time I meant it when I nested you in them. How ghostly and misaligned our caress would be if we held each other now. We never know the moment we end it. There comes an hour and it is over forever, the telescope of time tells us. Creation itself fills with shadow arms spinning in continual mismatch. It is only at great distance we ever know the moment we end it. So, thank you.